Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Massachusetts is a state of many firsts. The same is true about this state and slavery. Massachusetts was the first state to abolish slavery in 1783, but it was also the first state to legalize it 140 years earlier in 1641. And even before that, in 1621, when the Pilgrims were suffering through their first long winter at Plymouth, how was it possible that a member of the Pawtuxet tribe approached the starving colonists and offered his help, and he did so in English? Well, Squanto, or Tisquantum, had been enslaved by an Englishman in 1614 and then escaped bondage 3 years later. All of which is to say, slavery is as old as New England, though it's perhaps not talked about enough. And as Wendy Warren writes in her new book, the two violent enterprises of slavery and colonization were interlocking gears driving American history from the beginning. Warren is a professor of history at Princeton, and her new book is entitled New England Bound, Slavery and Colonization in Early America, and she joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. What an eye-opening book. I'm wondering if you could just start with what you describe slavery in New England looked like early on. Because frequently, I mean, we've talked a lot on this show about the slave trade, but I think comparatively less is talked about like people who were actually enslaved in the early New England colonies. Why were they, and what did their lives look like?
Well, their lives, the labor they did looked a lot like the labor of freedom. So what's distinctive about 17th century New England, I suppose, is that it's a period of settler colonization. Everything is still being settled, and there's no racialized labor regime. That is to say, the slaves do what colonists do. They work alongside them. In fact, recovering the labor of slavery in New England can be a little tricky because the labor can seem invisible because they're not doing different labor. Enslaved people hauled water, they cut trees, they worked in warehouses, they cooked dinners, they watered horses, they built houses, they hunted, they did the labor that needed to be done in a precarious colonial situation. What they didn't do is grow cash crops, for example. They didn't do the kinds of things that we more often associate with slave labor. It simply wasn't settled enough to do that. And in New England, they did distinctively New England things, all the things I just mentioned. Mm. So when we talk about this Atlantic system, which historians talk about a lot, this huge network of trade that envelops the whole Atlantic Ocean, it's important to remember that the people who are caught up in the heart of that system, who find themselves violently uprooted on one coast of the Atlantic and end up eventually, some of them in New England, do settle down in one place and do distinctive labor. Some of them surely end up on sugar plantations, yeah. A lot of them. But some of them end up in New England doing distinctively New England work.
Right. And in fact, I mean, they were so, these enslaved people were so, I don't want to say commonplace, but so much a fact of life in early New England colonial history that they even appear in moments and in events that are famous for other reasons. And I have to shamefully say, I had no idea. For example, you tell the story of an enslaved man named Juan who actually testified in the Salem witchcraft trials in 1679. Can you tell us about him?
Well, he doesn't testify in those trials, but he is in Salem earlier. It's a very typical New England slave story, I suppose. He's out getting firewood one day in Salem, and his horses bolt into a swamp, and it's with great difficulty, and if I recall correctly, with the help of bystanders, that he's able to get them back into their harness and doing what they should be doing. And neighboring colonists who've seen this, witnesses, and he all agree they've never seen horses behave like that, and they eventually all come to the conclusion that the horses have been bewitched. And they decide that a certain neighbor has done this. What is distinctive about this, what is peculiar, I suppose, or interesting, is that this man, his name Juan suggests, tells us that he's not from the region, right, as almost no slaves, African slaves, were in 17th century. So he's been caught up in this violent system. And what does he end up? What is the end result of this system? He hauls firewood in Salem. And what do we find him doing? Something so distinctively New England. He's caught up in a witch scare. Right. Eventually, he thinks he sees witches, and he testifies to that effect well before the trials, but right. Also in Salem. So it's this familiar Salem of witches, but it's a different Salem. It's a port town that faces the Atlantic in which enslaved people work, as in fact Salem was. It was a busy port town.
I mean, it's this brutal irony that you talk about, that in fact the work that the enslaved people were doing was so commonplace and so very New England that that's exactly the thing that rendered them invisible to history. But you also write that, for example, if I have this right, the first codification of slavery in the United States was written in New England, the Body of Liberties, in 1641. What was that?
That's right. That was just a code of law. I mean, 1641, Massachusetts Bay Colony, still very early in its existence, and they need to write up a code of law. So some colonists are assigned this task and do so, and one of the things they do is codify slavery. They say that there won't be any slaves unless they're caught in just wars, and for a couple other caveats. But of course, just wars are it's a very capacious category, and enslaved people are captured across the ocean, very often in wars. And by the time a colonist in New England or anywhere else buys them, their point of capture is long lost to history. So in fact, it turns out to be a very capacious law. It allows slavery pretty readily.
So tell us more about, all these examples that you give are leading me to ask, you know, you write very eloquently in the beginning of the book how, that language that I use is yours, about how the intermeshing gears of slavery and colonization were the two things that were really driving American history beginning in the 17th century. Tell us more about why they were so critical to each other.
Why is New England so successful? It's not just for, my students, when they enter my classes, believe very strongly in the myth of the sort of hardworking Puritan. But the New England colonies are part of an Atlantic system, and what's driving that system, what's in some ways funding New England, what's fueling the whole process is eventually sugar slavery in the Caribbean. And New England's caught up in that pretty aggressively. New England colonies are, Massachusetts Bay is closely tied to a place like Jamaica and Barbados. You know, by the 1670s, half the ships in Boston's harbor are coming directly to or directly from Barbados, or the West Indies in general. This is a huge connection. And so the success story of New England, I put success in scare quotes, if you will, but the successful colonization of New England is in large part derived from the power of these sugar plantations. So what we tend to see as distinctive entities, you know, the sort of unslaved New England colonies versus the slaved West Indian plantations, they're linked in ways that we haven't really acknowledged.
Yeah.
And early.
And were there early on sort of contemporary misgivings about slavery? Because, you know, I started echoing the story of Squantum that you write about in the book. And, you know, even people at that time had said that what had happened to him was wrong. But, of course, slavery remained legal in places like Massachusetts for, you know, more than a century or more or two thereafter.
Right. So I would say that the enslaved people immediately feel misgivings about the institution of slavery. But if we're talking about colonists, misgivings are voiced at various points for various reasons, but never systemic critiques, not until very late in the century, if even then at all. So you get occasional colonists sort of showing discomfort at perhaps how an individual or a couple of individuals were captured. But what you don't get is the systemic critique that will come later in the 18th century.
Mm. But you write about something called the Rainbow Affair.
So there is a case, it's, I think, oft cited as an example of New England's ambivalence towards slavery, in which some slaves end up in Massachusetts and they've been taken from Africa in a New England ship has sort of, the records are very laconic on this issue, but somehow the New England ship has gotten involved in an African slave raiding trip. And these slaves eventually end up back in Massachusetts, where their authorities come to learn that not only were they taken perhaps in an unjust war or an unjust raid, but moreover, they're taken on the Sabbath. Hmm. And this is a sort of extra crime on top of the possible crime of the unjust war. or raid. And it seems to be actually, if you look at the records, the Sabbath breaking is what troubles authorities most of all. So in this particular incident, the slaves are actually ordered back to Africa, returned to Africa. We don't know if that happened. There's no record that that did happen. And it's hard to imagine how you return a slave to West Africa. But it is this one moment where people do voice some discomfort. It's used, I think, it's been cited too often as example of some sort of inherent Puritan discomfort with slavery, which there wasn't really any such inherent Puritan discomfort with slavery. What it is discomfort with is breaking the Sabbath, which is more typical of maybe New England authorities' concerns.
Right. Well, in a way, to underscore that point, it wasn't until, as we talked about earlier, 1783, I believe, that slavery is abolished in Massachusetts.
Right. It happens quite late. And even then, it's a sort of gradual emancipation. So you have slaves well into the 19th century. You know, you're emancipated when you turn 30. But that can be, that's a lot of your adult life.
Yeah. And then also in the book, you write about how quickly this history, you know, has been forgotten. I mean, I'm not talking, you know, 20 or 21st century forgetfulness, but 19th century forgetfulness, because you write about how Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote in 1838 about his surprise seeing African-Americans at Williams College.
Right. So, in the 19th century, the Civil War plays a big role in how people understand and narrate by then the American states, the United States. And I think the North-South dichotomy becomes pretty entrenched. And people really start to think plantation slavery the moment the cotton plantation really is what slavery is. When people think of slavery, they think of the cotton plantation. So the early history and how it was actually scattered through all the colonies is a little lost by the end of the Civil War. And certainly now, in the 20th century, historians who were interested in slavery would not instinctively have gone to New England. There never really were that many slaves there. If you really wanted to work with slavery and understand plantation slavery and wanted voluminous records, you would have headed to the South. And I think that sort of perpetuated this false dichotomy.
Right. But in the last minute, few seconds actually that we have, as you say, in order to truly understand New England's success in the colonial era, we cannot divorce it from the slave history or the slavery history here.
Right. I think there's some use in understanding that people on a noble mission could really make some big misjudgments. I think there's some use in learning that lesson of humility.
Well, Wendy Warren is a professor of history at Princeton University and author of the new book, New England Bound, Slavery and Colonization in Early America. Fascinating book and a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've got more information about Wendy's book at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Mm-hmm.